Extension educators and teaches sustainable food production at UNH. She grew up on a small diversified farm in North Pomfret, Vermont, and received her bachelor's in art in biology at Dartmouth College and her PhD in plant genetics at Cornell. Before joining UNH, she experienced West Coast agriculture as a lettuce breeder at the USDA ARS Agricultural Experiment Station in Salinas, California. Her areas of interest are specialty fruit and vegetable crops and integrated pest and disease management. So this is quite a resume, and we're really honored that you're here today. And Becky will be talking today with us about small farming in New England, the sustainable edge, and making some contrasts and comparisons between New England farming and larger scale farming in California. Welcome.
Oh, thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be here today. And I wish I had as practical a PhD as Frank has here in this. I really like that.
I've got a broken one at home.
Nice. That would be a good compliment to the one I do have. Can everybody see the slides okay if I leave this like that? All right, I'll just keep running up there. So you've heard the introduction, so I don't need to give as much of it, but I was kind of planning to, so I will give just a little bit. This is a picture of the farm that I grew up on. And so I grew up experiencing New England agriculture. How many of you are from New England? And how many of you have experienced life in agriculture elsewhere outside of New England? Okay, so a lot of you have. Well, this may be enlightening or it may not be. For me, when I grew up in Vermont, this was what I knew. I knew diversified small-scale farming. The farm that I grew up on did beef cattle, they did greenhouse production, vegetables, blueberries, apples, maple syrup, you know, a little bit of everything. So I thought that's just kind of how farming was. And through my experiences, I realized that that's really not how it is in much, that's not where the majority of our food comes from. After I spent most of my time growing up in Vermont, I did go out and I spent my 5 years getting my less practical PhD out at Cornell. And so I experienced a little bit of a different agriculture there. Farms were still pretty diversified, but I saw some more of that kind of larger scale grain production, larger farms producing fewer crops. And but it was in many ways pretty similar. And I really wanted to, I was a vegetable breeder. I really liked vegetable crops and really diverse, interesting, what I considered to be interesting crops. And I wanted to stay working in those crops. And so when it came time to get a real job, when I finished up, I chose to go to California, the coastal part of California, which is known to be a very diverse vegetable production region. I didn't know much about it. And I knew that they raised an awful lot of fruit and vegetable crops out there for much of the country, and so they were hiring a lettuce breeder, so off I went. I ended up in Salinas, which is just midway in the coast of California. The Salinas Valley is this long, about 150-mile long valley that reaches in from the coast. It's a really temperate, cool climate, ideal for growing fruits and vegetables. This is an aerial picture of Salinas. It's also called the salad bowl of the world because quite a lot of our fruit and vegetable crops come from there. Most of our lettuce, for example. It's flat, you can certainly see that. To put it in a little bit of perspective, this is data from Monterey County, which is the county that Salinas is in. Monterey County, the value of the lettuce that's produced annually in Monterey County is worth more than all agricultural products produced in the state of New Hampshire. So it's a really different scale of production. It's really diversified. This is just a small list of what Monterey County produces on an annual basis, but it's a huge scale. 138,000 acres of lettuce alone. It's almost unfathomable. And this is what I'll show a lot of pictures because I just think these pictures are pretty powerful and haven't been in that part of the country. This is what one of those lettuce fields looks like. This is a pretty typical typical field. It's not something like what we see in New England, and it pretty much blew me away. They're laser level, so they really truly are exactly level. And the valley extends right to the hills on the outside, and so it's pretty much one farm runs into the next farm, runs into the next farm throughout the valley. Oh, I didn't mention, I would like for this to be, I have no specific place I need to get to in the talk, I'm just going to keep going, but I would encourage you to stop me and ask questions or interject comments if you like as we proceed through the talk. So don't worry about saving up, just holler out. I said it was diverse, and it is diverse. It's monoculture, but there's a lot of different kinds of crops. So I saw the biggest fields I've ever seen before of kale. Celery, this was an enormous celery field. The valley has an interesting climate in that the band of about 10 miles closest to the coast is maybe average highs of about 65 degrees in the summer, and then 10 miles inland it's about 75, and for every 10 miles or every 10 or 20 miles you go about 10 degrees higher. So at the bottom of the valley it's really hot. Maybe in the 100 degree, 105 degree range in the summer. But on the very edge, it's just 60. So you see a progression of crops down throughout, but the climate's very consistent all year round. So you see the same, so celery is kind of grown halfway down the valley.
Do they do much crop rotation within the groups, or is it almost continuous lettuce in the same field?
It's almost continuous cropping, although that's changing. I arrived there in 1999, and at that time, it was very common to see four crops of lettuce on the same field, and maybe they would throw in a crop of broccoli or something else to break it up for a short period of time, or a strawberry crop more commonly for 1 year, and then come back into four or five crops of lettuce. It has changed, and I never saw cover crops. When I left in 2004, I saw cover crops much more commonly in the winter months, and it was more common to see, it was more common to see cover crops than true rotational crops because of the fact that looking at profitability, which is what drives most of these farms, broccoli was recommended as a great rotation crop because of some of the biofumigant properties, but farmers couldn't make money. They'd lose money paying for the harvest of the broccoli, so it was actually more effective for them to put in a short-term cover crop than to put in a cash crop as a rotation.
Why would you say that shift happened? Why do you think they started including those cover crops?
The organic acreage went up, and this is organic acreage primarily by kind of the big companies, Tenamura and Antle, Earthbound Farms, Fresh Express, or Dole's organic segment. And so these bigger companies that were farming many, many thousands of acres started to increase organic acreage, and they needed to include a rotation plan. So they were kind of, or at least needed to include cover crops. So they were in some ways sort of forced into it. But I should say the other thing is, that monoculture system led to enormous disease problems. And so the battling those was becoming a real problem for a lot of reasons. They were using pretty much every tactic they possibly could to battle those diseases. Part of the reason they rotated into strawberries was because they fumigate with methyl bromide with the strawberries. So they would kind of wipe the slate clean. And then every crop afterwards would kind of ride on those effects of the fumigation for a few crops. So they were using those strategies and they weren't enough. And so they were thinking, okay, well maybe rotating into a cover crop is gonna have some real promise. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Two more.
Yeah.
What's the white? And then?
Oh, yeah.
And then fertility questions in that, both the standard commercial and the organic switch.
Okay, the white, it's actually not white, it's probably washed out color. It's the Golden Hills of California, which if you've been to California in the summer means brown. It's sort of, it's just dead grass. All the hillsides there are, it's really dry. We'll cover that a little bit later. I'll talk about the climate, but basically it doesn't rain from mid-March to the end of April, all the way through to about November. So there's all of the water that's applied here is irrigated, and those hills receive no water at all. So it's very, very arid. And the dark green that you're seeing are oaks and scrub trees, chaparral type stuff. They're not real leafy vegetation. And the fertility, conventional growers use primarily synthetic ammonium and calcium nitrate. Organic growers actually, I learned this last year, there are not big dairies in the area, so they don't have a ready source of manure. They buy primarily kind of pelletized chicken manure is the majority of, it's, so if you look at it, it's sort of a hopper that looks kind of like a granular synthetic fertilizer, but it's primarily chicken manure mixed with a few other things. That may not be all of them. Some do incorporate a small amount of compost as well, but that would not provide the fertility for a celery crop for sure.
Sorry, do you know if there are requirements for where the chicken manure has to come from?
I don't believe there are, but I don't know. I've actually been really curious, and I need to find out what. A lot of them are certified through California Certified Organic Farmers, and I don't know what CCOF's standards are. A lot of my students, I teach the Organic and Sustainable Food Production at UNH class, and they always ask me, well, how do they get away with such not stringent rotation plans? And I go, I don't know. It's, you know, it's up to specific certifiers to determine that. So I'm not quite sure how they phrase that. There's a number of other issues like that, like chlorine levels in the disinfection water. Mm-hmm. And East Coast certifiers don't really permit that, but the West Coast certifiers do in some levels. So it's kind of open to interpretation. I love this picture. I think that has got to be 2 weeks' supply for the entire nation of fennel. How many people eat that much fennel? I mean, it's wonderful. I love it. But that's a lot of fennel. That's incredible. Besides vegetable crops, I mentioned strawberry. Monterey County also does an enormous amount of fruit production. Watsonville, California, it's just over the county line in Santa Cruz County. This picture down here is either in Santa Cruz or Monterey County. The strawberry production, on kind of the borderlines, it gets sort of rolling hills. The strawberry production is a really different system than we use in New England. It's all an annual system. Because the climate's temperate all year round, they plant the plants on raised beds on plastic with drip irrigation in November. And then they start harvesting in about March. And they continuously harvest straight through to November or December of the next year. And then they pull them out and plant again. It does rely still pretty heavily on methyl bromide. You know that growers aren't allowed to use it unless they get a critical use exemption. And the strawberry growers in California are quite successful in getting those critical use exemptions every year. The industry is pretty dependent on it because of the system of pretty intensive monoculture strawberries.
Sorry, I don't know much about methyl bromide. Are there any lasting effects of it, or is it persistent?
Yeah, there are some persistent effects. What it does is it pretty much, when they fume, it's a fumigant. And so they tarp the field and they pump the gas in under the tarp, and the tarp remains in place for a couple weeks. And then they take it off, lay these strips, and plant. When it is pumped in, it kills everything within most soil organisms down to about 12 inches, 18 inches is what they're aiming at. And they're making a sterile environment that the plant is going into. that lasts for that crop, and then things start to slowly come back in and colonize. It takes a while. So I don't know how long those effects are, but I'm guessing in the 3 years plus range. I mean, one could certainly argue that it's much, much longer than that, since you're pretty much starting with a clean slate at that point. Actually, a side story that I wasn't going to necessarily get into, I don't know if it relates, but they were actually getting into trouble with that because there's a new, when I got out there was a new lettuce disease on the horizon, which made a plant breeder very excited because I could have a new project to work on. But it was a new crown rot of romaine. The romaine lettuces would just kind of die back at the crowns, and you'd walk through, and if you touched them, they'd just fall over. The growers were really upset about it because they didn't know where it was coming from. It seemed to be a new disease. Well, it turns out after 3 years of looking into it, it turns out that the causative organism was a fungal species called Phoma. Phoma is kind of omnipresent. It's everywhere, but it's not a very strong pathogen. You have to have a lot of it for it to cause problems. And it turns out that our best hypothesis, at the time that I left, our best hypothesis was it was most common in fields that had just come out of strawberry. The hypothesis was we were wiping the slate clean with methyl bromide, introducing Phoma again, because it kind of comes in on everything, and there was nothing else to compete and take out the Phoma. So the Phoma would go kind of nuts, and then it would take out the lettuce in the next crop, and then the field would kind of heal, and you wouldn't have crown rot problems. So you can see that there were some issues there. I mean, there's a lot of issues. At any rate, I have a picture of grapes. Grapes are a huge crop in that county now. A lot of what was the marginal lands, like the areas that were brownish on the hillsides, grapes don't need a tremendous amount of irrigation. They don't need a tremendous amount of fertility. And so while I was there, thousands and thousands of acres of grapes were going in the southern part of the county, which wasn't really suitable for growing high-value vegetable crops. So they are really taking off in that area. So this is not a California lettuce field. And you can tell because of the weeds. There's purslane. This is a Quebec lettuce field, which actually in many ways mimics the system that is used in California. But that level of weed control, I never would have seen a field like that in all of my time in Monterey County, because there's actually anti-weed ordinances in the county. You can't have weeds. don't you like that? It blew my mind, because all of my experience in the Northeast is, what do you mean no weeds? Weeds are, how do you keep them out? They mostly keep them out with herbicides, pre-plant and post-plant. They rely pretty heavily on that, but they also rely on mechanical weeding and cultivation. This is a mesclun field production, all baby greens for mechanical harvest. I'll show pictures of that in the middle. You can see the salt buildup, the soluble salts buildup here. This is weedier than most. I know that this, I had assumed that this was an organic field, although now that I look at those salts, I'm not convinced it is. That's atypically weedy for a mesclun field. And I'll show you why when you see how they mechanically harvest. There's just zero tolerance for weeds.
So did somebody enforce the no weed? Like, is there a weed police?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. There actually is. That it would be the Ag Commissioner's Department that would enforce that.
I mean,
and
would this person go to jail for that or whatever?
No, I don't think so, because they're not going to seed. If they were going to seed, they probably would. No, I don't know what they would do.
A quick question from someone from the Midwest. Do you have legally noxious weeds in the New England states? For example, mustard is considered a noxious weed in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And they have weed commissioners, my dad was one for a year, and it's their duty to write citations to property owners that have these noxious weeds growing on their farm. And my wife was paid a penny a plant to pull the weeds when she was a child.
Hmm.
Huh.
I don't know if,
labor laws.
I feel like we do have noxious, I'm pretty sure there are noxious weeds, and that's kind of, that's federally determined.
It's a legal term.
Noxious.
Yeah, yes, yeah.
Because it could be illegal to have it on one place and one state, not in another. Like both Canadian thistle is another one in Wisconsin.
Huh.
You have to cut, you're supposed to cut it.
I don't know, does anybody know? I'm not sure what the lead, I don't think that
so
we have as stringent.
Like no.
There are some, but I don't know what they are.
Yeah.
Here, you would know if what weeds were noxious in your county.
It's analogous to invasive plants.
Yeah, it is.
And enforcing it, so if people are planting them in their landscapes or something, saying they can't plant.
It's an allergy
area
or
whatever.
Yeah.
Right.
Not
the purple loosestrife.
They have field inspectors that do come for other purposes, and so you certainly would see if there was a problem, and they probably would take the opportunity to regulate at that point. They come because there's quality requirements that they enforce as the lettuce is packed in the fields. It can't have tip burn, for example, that would cause it to decompose during shipping. So I don't know. I never heard of anyone being enforced, but I never saw a weedy field either. So I don't know. It's an interesting question. This is actually this is a spinach field. This is how the spinach fields are actually weeded. It's not herbicide. This is an organic plot. And so when herbicides can't be used, they rely on the fact that there's incredible pool of low pay labor.
Skilled labor.
Yes, skilled labor, absolutely. A side note on the skilled labor, these folks belong to, they're employed by labor contracting crews. And so a farmer, when they want a task done in the field, they contract their labor contractor. And so there is a thinning crew that comes, the seed lettuce is direct seeded, and so the thinning crew comes with a special hose and thins it out to exactly 12 inches between plants. If they need a weeding crew, they call for a weeding crew. The big growers have their own, I'm sure, but we were farming the research station 80 acres, and so that was considered a pretty small operation. And so we would have a labor crew come in. And so they were very specialized, and they were very good at what they did, but this means this is what they did all day long, and they would go from farm to farm to farm and do that. And it is an incredible skill. I decided to thin one of my quarter-acre plots myself to get the experience. 8 hours later, and a very poorly thinned field, I was like, oh. It's really challenging. It's a major skill. This is a little bit hard to see. I wonder if we have half lights?
Yeah, sure.
I don't know, maybe you can see that. Oh yeah, that's better. This is one of the harvesting crews. They come in and they do that all in the field. My point in showing me this is that it's really heavily dependent on not only specialized labor, but mechanization as well. What you can kind of see, I don't know if I have more pictures in there, so I'll explain it here. You can see that there's a crew, this truck right here is the harvesting truck. There's a crew here actually doing the picking, the washing, the bagging, and the sorting, and the deciding whether the lettuce go into whole heads or bins for bulk or where they're going, depending on their quality. They're getting boxed in this truck here, and then those boxes are getting automatically shipped onto that truck, and that truck keeps leaving and going right back to the cooler. It's a steady stream, and there's other trucks waiting to come and back up and hook onto there. So it's really a heavily mechanized.
Does the packing station move?
It does. It's all self-propelled. It all moves at about a very slow walking pace. And it's doing probably, I don't know, 12 rows at a time or something like that. Oh, yeah, I did include a few more. So you can see they've got this little station. They're walking along. They're doing the washing for those are the little bags of hearts of romaine you see in the store. They're going straight into the field. Those up there are going for institutional use, all romaine hearts boxed in one box. And and then the sort of, then a bunch go into a hopper for bulk lettuce, where they'll get chopped and made into salad mix. So it all is happening right there in the field. Then this is, see they've gone along, and this part has already been harvested. You can see there's, it looks like there's a lot of waste, but all the middles of those heads are gone. There's probably five different products that the packers are deciding between and getting
sorted.
They're
grading them at the same time.
They're
so
grading, sorting, grading, washing, packing, picking, whole nine yards, all at once. And this is the gizmo. This is why there's no tolerance for weeds in that mesclun mix. This is a self-propelled greens harvester, and this is actually an endive field, I think. They go right along, and it's like a little cutter bars, and there's a little conveyor belt, sucks it up, and then it gets piped right over into the truck that's waiting, and then the truck takes it back immediately to be cooled. So there is no hand cutting. That actually changed while I was there. In 99, most of it was hand cut, and I saw crews on their hands and knees doing the cutting. And now, I didn't see that at all when I was leaving, or very, very rarely. This was most common.
So the price went from $12 a pound to $4.
Yeah, yeah. It really lowers the price, but it also lowers the weed tolerance and decreases the labor cost. It's all associated. Oh, yeah. Oh, good. I wasn't sure I had a picture of that either. Spinach field, where the spinach is actually being harvested, brought up, and then just dumped right into those trucks. I used to bike commute to work, and I would be biking along, and a spinach truck would pass, and all these spinach leaves would end up in your face. It was really kind of entertaining. It was different. Okay, so challenges that system is facing. It's a really well-developed agricultural system. It's pretty heavily dependent on mechanization. It's pretty efficient in terms of scale. They have got major water issues. As I said, it doesn't rain from pretty much March to November, which is the growing season is pretty much from January to November, and then they take a break for a month. But so they need to find water for all of that time, and it's all going to be, it's coming now from an underground aquifer. Under the Salinas Valley, there's three tiers of aquifer. They first tap the top aquifer. It's dry. They are now in the middle aquifer. They're halfway through it, and they're getting salinization from the seawater, saltwater intrusion in the top one. And I keep hearing different calculations as to far how long that third aquifer will last once they tap that. So they've got a major issue there. Manure is not available to them, so pretty much every input, fertilizer or pesticides, they're coming in, they're buying those in, they're not coming from that area. Every bit of that land is really, you saw from that aerial photo, it's all being cultivated. So it's not a very diverse operation. They're having to bring that in. Where there isn't agriculture, there's incredibly expensive housing. So the land is actually very expensive. People do not buy it. Even most of the farms don't own land. They rent land from major landholders. So that's a very expensive cost for them to face as well. And we heard about that in New England, but it's true there. Labor issues are enormous. They have an incredible source of a lot of labor, but it's putting a lot of strain on the cities. Salinas is a city of about 120,000. It's 50%, it's divided pretty much along Main Street. One side is almost exclusively Hispanic, the other side Mexican-American. The other half is not Hispanic. And it's the income is just divided right down Main Street. The east side is incredibly poor. They say that the density of people is higher than in Manhattan, even though it's all pretty much two floors because people are crammed into apartments. It's it's real poverty. And along that are coming gang issues. And it's the cost of healthcare there. There's so many social consequences to having that, that labor force that's not particularly well compensated. And I include this quote from the National Association of Home Buyers. I took great joy the time I lived out there. Salinas was always rated as the least affordable small metro area. 4.3% of the homes sold in the first quarter were available to medium income earners making $60,000. Most of the farm workers, the median sales price of homes was $545,000. Minimum wage is what most of the farmers would make, $6.75 an hour. Most seasonal labor would earn less than $10,000 a year. So there was just no possible dream of home ownership or condo ownership or anything. Rental prices were even high enough so that wasn't even feasible except for multiple families. So it was that there's a lot of challenges with that system, even where it's happening. Now this is starting to touch on how this relates to local agriculture. When you look at, this came out of this year's, one of the produce magazines from this January, I think. When the lettuce growers and broccoli growers, the big vegetable growers, break down their costs of producing a crop, or the total income they get from a crop, 36% of it go towards what the costs are of growing the crop. 4% of it is actually revenue to them, but almost 60% go into cooling and shipping. And as fuel costs go up, and accordingly, not only transportation, but the cooling also goes up because that's pretty energy consumptive. That's gonna take more and more and more and more. And so it actually turns out that many times out there when the market would be slightly down and the prices would be slightly low because there was a little bit of a glut, farmers would just disk in their fields because the cost of the cooling and the shipping and the harvesting was not going to compensate what they had spent so far. So they just say, well, at least let's cut our losses and get another crop in the ground now. So
this is a little off topic, but so the farmers, the farmers that are controlling these fields are not the owners of this land. They're leasing it from absentee. What's the turnover rate? Do you know
It's very low to none. It's a very different farm system. I thought that I had a slide in here on the size of particular farms. It's a different kind of system where very large landowners own many thousands of acres. They lease those to very large agricultural entities like Dole Fresh Vegetables and Tenemira Natal and DiRigo Brothers, these very, very large farms. These large farms operate, some of the largest ones are operating, I want to say like 450,000 acres. I mean, that seems like a lot, but it's an awful lot in both California and Mexico. So they farm many, many, many acres. What they do, so they do all that renting. They own a little bit, but they rent a lot. They then have separate ranches, so they hire ranch managers. The ranch managers make a good income, and they coordinate all the crews to get all the field operations done. But everybody in that family farm is kind of operating at the corporate level. The people who are doing the field decisions and those management decisions are paid employees. So, and then the people who are actually doing the labor are paid from that even. So it doesn't fit the model of anyone owning 5 or 6 or 10 or 20 acres or 100 acres and managing it. It's all rented. So there's a lot of, it's quite stable who is renting the land, and they may be renting it for 30 years, but
much land would those managers have each? So you have the,
yeah.
say Dole owns 500,000 acres. How many pieces, chunks would that be broken up to, into?
I can think of some ranch managers that would handle maybe a few hundred acres.
Okay.
And it would be throughout the valley, and they would have a few ranches they would be managing.
Mm-hmm.
And then there would, of course, be under that crew, foreman, and
yeah.
you know, many, many layers of people doing those managements.
Mm-hmm.
Now, interestingly enough, I mean, one of the things you think about when you start to figure who's actually making the farming decisions and trying to decide, you know, making steps towards increasing sustainability of this system, who's making those decisions about, well, what kind of source of fertility we're going to use, all that stuff, and when are we going to plant, and how are we going to crop? The cropping decisions, like the demand for when they need so much lettuce, is actually made by managers in the people who are actually dealing with selling and buying the produce. So they're not even on the farms. They're calling those farm managers and saying, yeah, I don't care how you do it, we need 4,000 acres of romaine on, you know, or maybe not that. We need 20 acres of romaine on Monday, we need 30 on Tuesday, and they're booking 6 months out. So they plan that so far in advance. So it's really, it's this weird decision tree. The scale means it's really efficient, but the scale makes it hard to innovate and make changes.
Sorry, is there room for those managers to make, like you're saying, make decisions about sustainability within that system if they're only being required to get a certain yield?
I think there may be, if they're required to get the yield. I don't know the answer to that. I think there is to some degree, but they have to make their yield.
Mm.
And
the only way that they can make that yield might be the production system that they're already using?
Yeah. Yeah, it might be. There was always... Just from my point of view, I did a lot of experiments on farm, and so I would need a small segment of a field. And the farm managers had absolute free rein to give me small chunks of field to do what I wished with. So there was some latitude there for sure. As far as adopting whole new practices, like rotation, maybe not using different fertility, perhaps. They do hire outside pest control applicators that do all of the pest control and scouting and applying and all that. So they would have to make different, set up different specs with those guys if they wanted to make a real change. Yeah. So this brings me to, so that's what I experienced there, which was very, very different from what I had grown up with. It was really enlightening. And the thing is, I should say, those farmers, every one of them that I worked with, if you ask them if they were caring for the land, if they wanted it to go on, the answer is yes, absolutely. They wanted to do the most sustainable practice. They, when we said, you know, would you consider cover cropping? Absolutely. But they are also facing those constraints of needing to have the whole system crash down if they couldn't sell their product. So it was, they absolutely had stewardship in mind, but they were in that system was very much not orchestrated.
So what happened then, like when all the spinach stuff was happening just now out
yeah.
there? I mean, what were they just disking everything in
yeah.
and starting over?
Yeah, spinach is a 30-day, baby spinach is like a 30-day crop for them. And so, They disked everything, and every day they were making those they were trying to say, well, you know, is it going to be blown over in 30 days? Should we plant now, or do we not even bother? You know, and they were all up in pins and needles, not knowing if they would be able to sell a crop in 30 days.
Well, so who's making those decisions? I mean, isn't there somewhere along the line the FDA saying the food's not safe at this point, and then at what point then, like, how do they, because they have no idea even where it came from along the whole line, so that...
That's right, and basically when that happened, they knew that they weren't going to be able to know, pinpoint exactly where that happened, because you can know that it did happen, you could know there's many possible routes that it could have, but they knew there was not going to be a pinpointed, we know what it was, we fixed it. Because it's just such a big process that it could get in at any point. And so the growers were feeling like, well, the FDA does that to try to mitigate risk in whatever way they possibly can. The growers were feeling like, well, we're still doing everything we possibly can. It's just a regulatory issue. When are we going to be able to sell the lettuce? So it's been going back and forth. And for a while, Mexico actually wasn't taking California lettuce or spinach. They weren't permitting that in. And now everything is totally, everything is open now. And
but you still see bags that say certified spinach free.
Yeah. Yeah, it takes a long time to recover from that. When I was out there, a similar thing happened with scallions. That was 3 years ago. The green onions from Salinas, there was a batch that were contaminated with E. coli, and it's still, we have 5 minutes left. So it lasts, those ramifications last a long time. So I'm not going to be able to probably get through the rest of my slides, which are all about local agriculture, but... I mean, I like the questions, and so I kind of want to open it up to comments. I think most of you have some familiarity with local agriculture and can kind of see the ways that it's different. And probably the biggest one in my mind is that we've got direct marketing here, and we're not tied into that that wholesale chain. And that direct marketing, whether it be through CSAs or farmers markets or small independent grocers, permits that relationship, and that relationship means some accountability, which means maybe a more sustainable system.
I see this kind of like pull between the East Coast and the West Coast, and as far as policy goes, I mean, East Coast for small and direct marketing, West Coast for big marketing and big business. As far as policy goes, my hunch is that it's going to continually shift west, because that's the business, that's where the money is. So, I mean, how do you think it's going to, how can we on the East Coast pull it our way? Like, how, you know, I mean, do you see a shift happening? Do you have a gut about this, like a gut feeling about it, or, I mean, what do you think?
Well, I think that the West Coast has economy of scale, and they are always going to have that. There are so many factors that are pulling, that mean that they can produce at a very high efficiency and a very big scale that the East Coast will not be able to do. However, so perhaps nationwide export food policy may shift towards and bias that. However, in the East Coast, we have a tremendous potential to build local infrastructure, and perhaps that, I don't know, does that need federal, I mean, does that need policy? I mean, what kind of policies would benefit that? I'll throw that out. Charlie's nodding. What policies does that need? What policies would benefit that?
I guess it, one of my things at the moment is labor. It's hard to get enough labor, skilled labor, to work on the eastern farms, which have very low return for their effort. And I don't know where it goes. Well, actually, there is one thing that could be set up in New Hampshire, for instance, which is an apprenticeship program so that people who are interested in learning these skills could move on to significant farms in a relatively structured manner. And there's a lot of states that do this in these.
Without skirting the labor laws.
Without skirting the labor laws, doing it. I mean, we want to get to a point where farmers and their laborers are paid legal living wages, which these guys in the West are not either.
No.
It would be, you know, it'd be nice if we could do that in our food system. That would be a sustainable goal.
Yes.
Well, we have an abundance of migrant workers coming north, as
well as
we don't have that in the East.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Certainly do in the South.
Yeah. So
we do in the East as Northeast. We have some, but that wouldn't necessarily be, I'm not sure that's a sustainable approach either.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I mean, that's certainly the labor out there. It's labor, but it's not people having living wages.
Yeah.
not training people to be farmers for the future.
And it's not developing all the other things that, that potentially can go into this sort of relationship, which is that of community, of having useful things to do, of connection to the land and the beauty of the land and preservation and, you know, enhancing the environment and so on.
And if we can look at that example, the community is suffering in a big way. I didn't explain.
Main Street.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, it's suffering and not a thriving community.
And so that's not something we want to sustain.
No.
Or is it, it's probably going to break down.
At some point.
That economy of scale is going to have a huge impact on the East Coast too, because as long as they're able to produce at such low prices, you'll constantly have this conflict between the expense of producing food in this direct way, small scale, and the price of food in a supermarket that's been shipped over from California. And as long as that contrast is there, it's going to become a class divide in many ways, and it'll make sort of direct marketed food appear to be far more expensive than the food that's available from California. So in that way, they're definitely influencing one another in a big way. I don't know whether there's any way to resolve that, but
you're absolutely
I was just going to make the comment, but you do have the advantage of the shortness in shipping. You don't have the transportation costs.
Mm.
That's right. Or the cooling costs as winter approaches.
Right.
Yeah, and as you said, that's 70% of it. So.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the advantage on the East Coast.
But we still can't make it in the East Coast, at least here. I mean, I know at this point of two or three CSAs in this local area that are going out of business this year.
Well, perhaps I think that's an excellent segue to the next discussion, but maybe CSA is not the sustainable model because it sounds as though in many ways that's not providing the living wage that is really a key part of that community supporting. I don't know. Good segue for the next one.
Yeah, I'm sorry to cut this off. It's a very compelling discussion. And perhaps those of you who want to continue the discussion during the coffee and tea break can stay and do so. But for those of you who want a break and some caffeine and some energy for your body, as you move your body a little more, we do have 10 minutes before we begin the next panel session. So please take time if you want.